Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The OSU College of Public Health a few years ago decided to tap into social media to raise awareness of how the college works to help people live healthier. Social media is cheap, sure, but it does take time. Joining us now to talk about how it works for the OSU College of Public Health is Christine O'Malley. She's Executive Director of External Relations and Advancement. That's a big fancy title, Christine, at the OSU College of Public Health. Welcome to the show, Christine.
Hi, Ann.
Also with us is Deborah Jasper, digital media consultant and co-founder of Mindset Digital. Welcome back, Deborah.
Thanks, Ann. Great to be here.
You've been on the road for a while now.
We have.
So when did the College of Public Health begin using social media, and how did you get it started, Christine? I mean, what was the impetus in the first place?
Sure. Well, we really wanted to figure out a way to share some of the great stuff that we're doing to help people live happier, healthier lives. And so we kind of dipped our toe in 2007 into Flickr, which is a way to share photos. But it really wasn't until 2009 when I attended one of Deborah's workshops.
Yay!
where we really started to learn about how to use tools like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. And I realized along with everybody else in the room, that this really is a space we needed to be in.
But, you know, it's not, it does take time. I mean, it seems cheap, and you're not necessarily shooting for it as a business. In other words, you're not necessarily trying to generate advertising on it or anything, or are you?
No, we're not trying to generate advertising, but it's a great way to communicate with our audiences who are, students, alumni, colleagues in other institutions, public health professionals, and it does take time. So, but it can also be fun. But one of the main things we try and do is kind of measure our success. I think it's really important if you're going to be using social networks for your organizations that you measure the impact that they're having for you.
Yeah, they often say if you can't measure it, you don't have a strategy. Or, you know, other folks say, really, if you're not measuring it, then you really don't have the impetus to get better. You've really got to understand, oh, that works. Oh, that doesn't. A lot of this is experimentation. I mean, the good thing about public health, we were talking about this earlier, is, you know, it's not like they're an insurance company or they're sort of selling, fabric softener. It's easier to get people to get engaged with you if you're saying, look, let's talk about sort of the cool topics that they talk about in public health, leading healthier, happier lives, cool food, you know, things for foodies, talk about some of the things that you think have really engaged.
What are some of the
people.
Subjects? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, for instance, we have this alumna, Ellen Yard, who works for CDC, traveling the world.
The Centers for Disease Control.
Right. Mm-hmm. Traveling the world on public health projects. And everywhere she went, she brought her Buckeye gnome. It's this little gnome statue.
I know what it is.
Yeah, and so she takes a picture of herself with the gnome every place she goes. And when she shared this with us, we were like, oh, my gosh, we have got to tell everybody about that. And so we made a cute little video with her photos, and people just loved it. And so it's a great way to talk about Ohio State, public health, putting our alumna out there.
Her travels. You know, that's the key, though.
It's just to get people.
It's the key is engaging content.
Right.
You know, so you can't just lecture people all the time. You know, they could be out there lecturing. Here's what you need to eat healthier. You need to exercise. You need to do these things. Or you can be saying, let's have fun with this and let's get you engaged in a much more fun way. But one of their most popular videos is really a serious topic.
Right. It's a topic about how community members view research. So we have a prevention research center, and there are actually several centers around the country, all through CDC. And so our team decided to make a video about what community members think about research. And it is a serious topic. And the video ended up being 10 minutes long, which in YouTube land is
forever.
Really long.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was kind of concerned about how this, you know, if we would get anybody watching this. But it turns out it's one of our most viewed videos because other centers around the country started using it for training.
So sometimes it just, you know, you can do serious topics, but if you do them well and people say, oh, this really is useful, then you can get a ton of views. What we talk about a lot, though, when we do these fast forward camps, you know, and our sort of 3-day trainings is really the power of small numbers. we get all caught up in, can we reach a million people? But, you know, they reached over 1,000 people, but it's 1,000 critical people. So sometimes it's not so much about how many people you reach, but are you reaching the right people? So we're leading two as part of this Ohio State initiative. There's a lot of digital stuff going on at Ohio State right now, but we're leading a big social media initiative. And we've trained mostly all of the communicators at Ohio State. So nearly all 50 communicators with the University of Communications has gone through, a lot of communicators from each college. A couple weeks ago, we taught all of the deans at Ohio State how to tweet. And next week, we're doing strategic Twitter. Now, we're not saying every dean at Ohio State is going to be tweeting, but they do recognize that they need to understand this space. I said it sounds like a great band name, the Tweeting Deans, doesn't it?
That does sound like a great band name.
But you start to realize that whatever college you're in, whatever information you're trying to share, you've got to do it in a more informal, visual, engaging way. And Ohio State is engaging in this in a big way because they're understanding our students today. You know, they expect you to be on Facebook. They expect to find information from you on Twitter. They're expecting visual storytelling. So they're using a lot of visuals. Do you want to talk about the visuals you're using in class?
Joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guests are Deborah Jasper. You just heard her. She's a digital media consultant and co-founder of Mindset Digital. Also with us is Christine O'Malley of the OSU College of Public Health. And we're talking about how the OSU College of Public Health has incorporated a social media strategy into their communications operation. So, Christine, go on.
So, Deborah was just mentioning about how some of this communications technology is being used in the learning environment. And so one of the great things for us in public health is we moved into this wonderful building that was renovated, and we moved in last fall. So all of the classrooms have the up-to-date technology, software, they're all wireless. And so our faculty are able to record their lectures or use, the technology to bring in guest speakers, which is very environmentally sustainable because you're not spending, jet fuel to fly them across the country. And it's great for the students. And some of our faculty have done research with their students about how they're using those tools and have discovered that even students who are attending classes go and rewatch the lectures. For a class like biostatistics, you really want to be able to make sure that you're catching everything. And so it just really helps the students.
I can tell you, if I was taking biostatistics, I would go and watch the lecture again. Because, you may not get it all the first time. Don't you wish you had that when you were in school?
I was taking biostatistics. I'd probably be watching it 5 or 6 times. there's different platforms have had different levels of success, though, right? Not everything works, Christine.
Well, it really, are you talking about the classroom? Or are you talking about social?
Just social media in
general. Yeah, no, you're right. Because you really want the content and the audience to match the network you're using. So a tool like Facebook has been great for us because we can share with people who already have a connection to us in some way, our alumni, our students, public health professionals. So the content we put out there, I can tell, is really engaging because people like our content, they share our content, and I can also tell using my analytics that they're coming to our website from Facebook. So I can see that what we're putting out there on Facebook really fits. For Twitter, it's a completely different network, and I think the people on Twitter are looking for a different kind of engagement. They're much less likely to click on any of the links that we put out there. It's a very immediate tool.
And people are finding it harder to get people to click on links. A blogger the other day was saying it's just almost nil. It's really hard these days because so much is coming at us.
So what is Twitter
for? That it is really
then?
Hard to get people to go further. Well, some of it is, if you're coming across my feed a lot, you're staying top of mind. So even if I'm not clicking on your links, I'm saying, oh, there's the College of Health. I'm reminded of you, and I'm seeing sort of quick glimpses of what you're doing, sort of the headline version. So some of what Twitter is being used for is just to stay top of mind, to remind people that you're out there and remind people of what you're doing. But it is a challenge. So we were talking earlier that we're seeing a lot more people start to use Twitter as thought leadership. So you're starting to say, okay, here I'm going to really develop, I'm going to show you that I'm an expert in my field. on Twitter. I'm going to talk more about here's what I know about social media. Here's the latest stats. Here's, you know, all of that sort of thing. Whereas on Facebook, it's more about people who know me. So we often say with Facebook, it's like, okay, these are the people who know us and like us and are engaged with us. Twitter might be the people that we want to get to know us or might be the people that we want to get to know. So I'm following the smartest people in my field on Twitter, and I'm saying, and they're doing research for me all day. But I'm not necessarily clicking into everything they do. I mean, every now and then I'll say, oh, five people have tweeted about this, so this must be important. But then I'm only clicking on one of those links. So you have to think about these as very different spaces. We think people make a mistake when they just use their Twitter feed. They post their tweets on Facebook or vice versa because they're different channels and there's different expectations. Is that what you're finding?
I would very much agree with that. You know, our audience on Facebook, they're interested to know about the college and about public health, right? On Twitter, it's, like you said, much more thought leadership about public health and maybe less interest in, you know, what's going on in the college about the new building or, you know, this faculty member or something like that.
Right. It's more thought leadership. Yeah. More. We are experts in public health. You know, we're going to give you the latest and we're going to give you news that's useful to you. So really different spaces. And Pinterest, another new channel that mm-hmm. increasingly people are starting to get into. We were just talking about the College of Public Health and thinking about how they may use Pinterest.
Yeah, I have really enjoyed Pinterest on a personal level, and I can see a lot of application for our college. So if you're an organization and you're thinking, how can I use Pinterest, right? So what it is, it's this photo sharing network. You can share photos all around the web with people who follow you. You pin it to your pin board, and then people who like your content can repin it. And what's great is that the original URL that you originally linked to stays with it. So if you're an organization, right, you want to use your content to have people like your stuff. Well, what people are posting, a lot of food, a lot of travel, a lot of art. So my organization, I'm thinking, all right, there's a food aspect here. How can I use that? So for this year, and especially after going through Deborah's workshop in April, I want to figure out how I can use Pinterest to really further awareness about healthy food, but in a fun way.
Yeah, it really is about being, you know, it's about having fun in this space. We think of Pinterest as sort of Twitter with photos, Twitter for photos. Mm-hmm. So instead of sending out a tweet, you're sending out a great photo and people say, oh, I love this and let me post. But Pinterest is hugely popular. It's the third most popular site now behind Google. It's more popular than Google Plus, and it's more popular even than LinkedIn. So it's hugely popular and it's still predominantly women.
When I'm using TweetDeck for mm-hmm. Twitter, every time something posts, it pops up. Mm-hmm. I get a little brief mm-hmm. mention of it. Can you do the same thing with Pinterest?
You do get notified when people repin your content.
Yes, but you don't have something pop up on your screen.
I think that would drive you crazy.
It would drive yeah. Frankly, the post, the way it works yeah. on yeah. Twitter,
you
or
can
TikTok
turn that off.
Drives me nuts. I know.
You can turn that off.
But on
off.
The other hand, I've been right up to date on certain news
yeah,
that
right.
I really care about, so
yeah,
I'm afraid to turn it off.
Right. I know. It's the struggle. I turned it off because I thought it would drive me crazy. But
Richard in Wyland Park, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Ann. I'm a graduate student at Ohio State, and I watched with interest as the renovation of Clint's Hall was done for the college. I'd like to know how the public forums and the new facility integrate with each other and what things are offered to the public with the new building.
How the public forums?
Or are you offering some public forums? How are you using the new building to integrate with the public?
Right. Well, one of the things that we've done is, you know, particularly with the classrooms, being able to use distance learning. So while it's not necessarily general public, you can sign up for a course and use that distance learning option. So we had a course, I think it was cardiovascular epidemiology, which is sounds like a very technical topic, but actually we had some people somebody from Akron sign up and maybe Cincinnati, you know, who can join long distance. So you don't have to actually be on campus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not something that we were able to do before we moved into this building.
Thank you, Richard, for that call. We appreciate it. Well, we've run out of time. I told you it would go quickly, Christine.
Wow, that was fast.
I know. It just flies by when you're having fun. Deborah Jasper, thanks for joining us as usual.
Thank you, Ann. Great to be here.
Deborah Jasper, she's digital media consultant and also co-founder of Mindset Digital. And Christine O'Malley. Christine, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Christine O'Malley. She's with the OSU College of Public Health. Coming up, Steve Fox, we're going to talk about those ultrabooks. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
WOSU Public Media presents the Chefs in the City online auction. You can bid now on fabulous culinary-themed packages. Bid on items such as a luxury weekend escape for two in Washington, D.C., a day of indulgence with a nationally recognized makeup artist, or a private stand-up wine reception at the refectory. But hurry, these packages close this Thursday. All proceeds benefit children's educational programming on WOSU. Visit WOSU.org/chefs to view all items up for bid.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment managers providing financial advice and client-focused solutions to help grow and preserve clients' wealth. The Sherrington Group, planning for success, managing for life at sherringtongroup.com.
Showers and thunderstorms popping up today, cloudy skies, and partly cloudy tonight as well, a low of 61 degrees. Sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 77. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
So, the definition for the word ultra means to go beyond the others. So, joining us now to talk about whether that fits the bill with the new Ultra Books is Steve Fox, Editorial Director and Vice President at PC World. Welcome back, Steve.
Good to be back, Ann.
So, the whole Ultra Book thing, is that a generic term, or did someone come up with that and now everybody else has embraced it?
Well, I would imagine that somebody was probably paid good money. So what were we doing that we didn't come up with it first? But in fact, it's specifically an Intel term. You know, Intel very often drives the computing industry and PCs and the like. And you know, they took a look at things like the MacBook Air, and they said, and as well as all these other mobile devices that are coming up that are lightweight and everything else, and realized, hey, we have to figure out a way that we can continue to sell PCs because, you know, people are just going to stop buying them. And they came up with this definition of the ultrabook. It's a very very lightweight, lower power consumption, very thin, slick looking. They're great looking laptops, notebooks. You know, I suspect that people are going to absolutely want to get these things. I mean, clearly the MacBook Air has done very well. But now you want something similar on the PC side. What we are right now, I mean, it's probably not too dramatic to say that we are at the cusp, right, at a turning point in the, you know, in the laptop industry, being driven very much by Intel. And June is the magic date. So, you know, here we are at the end of May, mm-hmm. And here's the heads up. A lot of things happen in early June that mean that a lot of these ultrabooks. And ones that people will absolutely want, they're all going to come out, you know, let's say somewhere in the first half of June. I mean, for one thing, you've got this new chip from Intel that's going to be widely available, and that's called the Ivy Bridge chip. You know, that's a code name, and people don't know that, but it's basically this third-generation chip. It's faster, uses less power. Lots of, you know, it's Intel keeps on pushing on this, and, you know, they keep coming out with better chips. So you have the Ivy Bridge chip becoming available for all kinds of manufacturers to use. Another little piece that's happening here, you've got a huge computer show in Taipei, and that which happens, you know, every year. That's called Computex. Not a show that, you know, most of the readers probably go to, but for the industry, big deal, second biggest computer or technology show in the world. That starts on June 5th, and you know they want to somehow, Intel wants to make sure that there's a lot of ultrabooks that are on display there. And then your third piece, I would say, is that Windows 8 from Microsoft, pulling all these strings together, we're going to see a new release of Windows 8, what's called the release preview, which is really closer to the final version. That is going to come out in early June, and you'll probably see that.
Are the ultrabooks just a matter of size and weight and energy consumption at this point?
Well, I mean, you could say they're only that, but that's kind of a big thing. When you think about ultrabooks, what you think about is low power,
You know, they turn on quickly. They've integrated graphics, which means that the graphics are kind of built right into the chip. So they're very thin. I mean, these are things you can they're very lightweight, right? So you can just, you know, tuck it under your arm. And, you know, I've been looking at the various weights on a lot of these things, and they range from, you know, two pounds up to about four. So remember, we've seen very lightweight, essentially PCs before, mm-hmm. right? But a lot of them were so underpowered that, you know, nobody really wanted them, or not nobody, but, you know, the netbooks, for instance. Then Toshiba has just announced they're not doing netbooks anymore in the U.S., right? So people don't want to make the compromises. So instead, you're getting really a full-fledged, fast, beautiful-looking laptop. You're probably paying, right now, I'd say the cost is going to be the big issue. You know, these things will come in, and a lot of them around $1,000. I think there's a magic figure here which says that, I don't know, you have to hit maybe $600 to $700 before everybody jumps on this, because, you know, you can get other laptops that are heavier and the like for $650, $700. So it'll hold the price down. When you get to the and that is something all the vendors will be working towards, to actually get this price down. I think this first batch that comes out in early June, most of them will be in the $1,000 range. We've seen some really good looking preview versions in our office. You know, things like the Asus ZenBook, and I think that'll be around $1,100. Something just showed up end of last week on Amazon. You know, if you are constantly looking around for this, it was a preview of something that you could order from Dell. A beautiful looking, very lightweight laptop for about $1,200. That seems, you know, super thin. Not available yet, but, you know, clearly with all the full specs, it's part of what will be this incredible just splurge here sometime in the beginning of June, when all of a sudden they're all going to go on sale.
My guest is Steve Fox, Editorial Director and Vice President at PC World. If you have a question or comment about the Ultrabooks, you're welcome to give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org and go into our All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. So let's talk about the size. The new Dell XPS 14 is just, well, it's less than three quarters of an inch thick.
Right.
How about durability?
Which is impressive.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'll see about that. I mean, you know, here's a point. I don't want to downplay the importance of that, because it is important. But, you know, when you used to pay $2,500 for a laptop, you were really concerned about durability.
Yeah, that's a good
point.
And
when these things get to you know, 700, as they will eventually. I mean, my guess is a lot of these are what are called unibody designs, so they should be kind of durable. So we'll see on that. Some of them will have solid state drives, which will be very good for both in size and also, you know, when you think about what breaks on laptops, drives are kind of the number one thing, because, you know, think about it, your regular hard drive, it's a mechanical thing. It's this platter that's spinning at an incredible speed, and then there's something on it which, you know, looks almost like your old-style photograph record. It's not, of course, but that's kind of what it looks like, that's reading this information. And, you know, that's prone to breakage, although they've done wonders on insulating it. So as you get SSD stuff, you know, I think that will actually help in some of the durability on this. You know, the idea that, you know, fewer parts when you have this, you know, the discrete graphics and, you know, everything is integrated. Integration, you know, tends to help on overall durability. Of course, it means when something breaks, then, you know, then you're hosed because you can't take anything out. But to be honest, no one's ever really done much in the way, or that much at least, in the way of repairing notebooks. So when you look at something like this, you know, what we refer to here as the mystery Dell XPS 14, because it's actually not available yet, it's actually exciting. It's been a while since PC users who, you know, stare over at the Apple crowd, you know, longingly and say, how come they get all the cool stuff? Mm. Well, you know, guess what? There's some cool stuff that's coming out here as well. And as is typical, when it comes out on the Windows and PC side, the price tends to be less. So you're not going to pay as much of a premium. You will have to skip some things, right? It looks like the Dell, for instance, does not have an optical drive. I mean, you know, clearly the MacBook Air and others do not either. So, you know, they take some things out. Of course, if you're...
Okay, what's an optical drive?
You know, so a DVD drive, any of that good stuff for bringing in externals. But we're connected all the time at this point, or it certainly seems that way. So there's a way to get information in there. I should probably mention one more, you know, key factor here, and it's the thing that looms over all of this. It has to do with Microsoft and Windows 8. And, you know, as I mentioned, there's a preview release, but, you know, most people are saying that Windows 8 is going to come out at the end of this year, or sometime toward the end of this year. And these Ultrabooks, from what we can see and the stuff that's being announced at Computex, a lot of them will be able to or will be running Windows 8. And that's, you know, that is a big deal. Because, you know, whole new operating system, one of the things that happens whenever Microsoft comes out with a new operating system, just as whenever Intel comes out with a new chip, it tends to be a spur for buying for a lot of people. And a lot of people are actually going to look at these Ultrabooks and say, yeah, I like that, but I'm waiting until, let's say, Windows 8, because I don't want to do the upgrade, even if it might be free. So, you know, that's kind of the one piece that's hanging over all of this and then could possibly affect sales because people may want to wait until Windows 8.
Sean in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about Windows 8. What experience have you had with it? How much of an improvement over 7 is it? I'm stuck with Vista currently, and how much better would you rate it than that? Second question, and I'll take my response off the air. Can you tell me a little more about the new chip Intel will be bringing? What are we talking about? How many cores, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Dave. Yeah. Thank you, Sean.
Yep. Okay. So Windows 8 question is going to come around very much to personal taste. I think because I've used it quite a bit, I like it very much. I actually think it's a really great smart interface, especially when you have touchscreen capability. Most people do not. I have a suspicion that people are going to scream and holler and not be happy. A lot of people about Windows 8, even though it is, I think, a very well designed interface. You know, the issue there is I'm not sure we're going to get a whole lot more speed out of where we are with Windows 7. I think a lot of people who are on Windows 7 are going to be quite happy. The gentleman who called is on Vista. You know, not that many people are wildly happy about Vista. Windows 7 seemed to fix a lot of those problems, and I suspect that a lot of people are just going to stay with Windows 7. Believe me, I am out in the field a lot, and I see a lot of people on XP still and have no intention. That's, you know, we're going generations back.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see. Windows 8, I think, could be a tough sell. I think Microsoft needs to do it because they need to come up with a modern operating system that addresses things like touch interface. But, you know, there's going to be quite a lag between people who have touch screens and a lot of these other capabilities that can really take it, that will really make Windows 8 shine. So that could be a problem. As far as, you know, not to get, you know, too technical on Ivy Bridge, which is, you know, that's follow up to Sandy Bridge. It's you know, they'll have the Core i5, they'll have the Core i7, which are the same, you know, Intel models that they had before. They're just, you know, it's basically zipped up. A lot of it here is, Ivy Bridge has, and there'll be a whole number of different cores, and I haven't actually seen their full list of how many cores are going to be available in each chip, but, you know, it is very much a multi-core, of course, multi-core architecture. The main thing on this is it's going to be a lot less, it'll draw a lot less power. And when you have drawing a lot less power, That makes all kinds of great things possible for the manufacturers who are taking the chip and building PCs out of it. So I think a lot of people will actually want this Ivy Bridge microarchitecture. You can also see it identified, I think, often as third generation, because, again, Ivy Bridge is a code name. And, of course, there are things that come out after Ivy Bridge. This is not the end of the line for Intel, but this one coming out right about now, this is their state of the art.
So how many different kinds are out there?
In terms of Ultrabooks?
Ultrabooks, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, right now there's more like a handful.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect if we talk next week, there will be a bushel full and then several bushel fulls 2 weeks after that.
Okay.
So, you know, what you have is Asus and Dell and Toshiba and, you know, all the major manufacturers are doing their versions. HP, I actually saw something called the HP SleekBook, which they say is, you know, not an Ultrabook. I haven't had a chance to get my hands on it yet. I don't know why it's a SleekBook and not an Ultrabook. The specs seem the same. So maybe somebody's deviating a little. We'll have to see.
So if you're going to give advice to people about what to look for, what sort of quality should they be looking for?
Well, you know, because this is primarily, much of this is an aesthetic experience, you want to see what it looks like. But what you're looking for, you want to hold it. I mean, my best advice that I can have for buying a laptop is, you know, get a feel of, you know, pick it up, see what it feels like. It is amazing to me, because I was a skeptic. I carried around some pretty heavy laptops in the past, and I always thought, what's the difference of, you know, 1 pound? And guess what? When you're carrying something from your shoulder, it actually makes a difference when it's in the bag. So pick it up, you know, feel it. Obviously, you're going to do some, you know, you'll do your price comparisons. You need to figure out what kind of computing you do, you know, how far, because, you know, there's Core i5 and there's Core i7, which will have a little more power. If you're willing to pay a little extra money for more power, you know, go for it. A lot of people, what they're primarily doing is going online and using some simple applications. They're probably not going to need, you know, something that completely cranks and is the most powerful. So, you know, you need to figure out what your use is, you know, what your use is. I mean, I think the thing to recognize here is we really are getting into this new era. I think where weight and things like usability are paramount. Used to be, you know, it was all about power, right? More power. And now it's about efficiency. This is where we're turning, you know, longer battery life, thinner, less weight. And I think that will define this particular era of computing for quite some time. When you think about all the portable devices that we have that are also playing in this space, right? Because you can do a lot of this on your phone. I wouldn't advise editing a whole manuscript that way, but hey.
Jeremy in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Jeremy.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a quick question. Has the guest had any chance to have his hands on any of the AMD Trinity versions of the Ultrabook?
So I have not. We do have some in the office, and currently we're playing around with it and we're doing the tests. We haven't finished the testing on this yet, so I can't speak to it. Obviously, you know, AMD has gone up and down. At times they've been on top. At times they feel like a very distant second, which is kind of what it feels like right now. But, you know, I think they will have a shot with this. One thing, I'm sorry I can't actually give you the answers, because until we've actually finished, you know, really doing everything, it's hard to make an assumption on this. Obviously, they're not going to be totally, you know, frozen out of this. But, you know, Intel is spending a lot of money on pushing the idea of Ultrabooks. I'd hate to be AMD going up against the Intel behemoth, just in terms of marketing alone, as people look at these new Ultrabooks. And that will be a challenge for them. I long to see and hope that AMD can come out with something really great.
Okay, Jeremy, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it.
And one last comment. I think one of the previous callers, you were mentioning a SleekBook and what makes the difference. I believe
yeah.
The SleekBook is the AMD version, so they're not allowed to call it an Ultrabook. So
right. And it does have a new chip. But if you look at the specs on it, in terms of weight and all that other stuff, looks like an Ultrabook, right? So, but yes, like it is a marketing thing that they cannot. So, yeah, absolutely, it's AMD's. That's correct.
Thanks again, Jeremy. And Steve Fox, thanks to you for joining us again today.
This was fun. Talk to you next week.
Hopefully. Steve Fox, Editorial Director and Vice President at PC World. Coming up, Russell Holly from Geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Stay with us in 20 minutes, starting at noon, for Fresh Air and a conversation with journalist Andrew Bloom, the author of Tubes, A Journey to the Center of the Internet. That's on Fresh Air from noon until 1 here on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for Tech Tuesday comes from Soho Tech, providing computer consulting services to residential and small business customers. More information at 323-4085 or online at sohotechcolumbus.com.
A chance of showers and thunderstorms popping up this afternoon. Cloudy skies for today, highs in the mid-80s. Partly cloudy tonight, a low right around 61 degrees. Mostly sunny for Wednesday and a high of 77, and then clear skies Wednesday night, a low of 53. More sunshine for Thursday and a high of 72. Be sure to listen to 89.7 NPR News by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org and click on the Listen Now button at the top of the page. And you can listen to our station from your computer or mobile device. Just visit WOSU.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
For many among us, the idea of an intelligent house invokes images of the Jetsons with automatic food prep and other amenities. As far as we know, that's not even remotely possible yet. But maybe just around the corner? There have been, however, serious advances in recent years. Joining us to talk about that now is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holly. Welcome to the show, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So you're joining us today to talk about home security and in particular the Vivint security system?
The Vivint system.
Vivint. You know what? I always wonder, am I ever going to pronounce these things correctly? But go ahead, Russell. A user of this system said that they can use their smartphone to unlock their houses from a distant location, watch the person on the phone while they're inside their house, then lock the door behind them when they leave. That's amazing.
It's definitely an interesting thing to kind of see firsthand. I've spent a lot of time with one of their setups recently, and it was just a really kind of unique experience for all of it to be controlled. You know, you can control it from in the house the same way you control everything else. You know, you walk up to the panel and you turn on your security system, but you know, if you're away, you can evaluate everything from your phone from one application. And just like you said, you can look at security cameras that you've set up in your house. The locks on the doors you can control remotely. You can activate the house alarm to alert the police and the fire department. You even have control over the thermostat in your house to adjust temperature controls for when you're not away. There's a lot that goes on with this particular piece of software and the different things that get installed in the house that really kind of bring it together to make it feel like you've got a smart house.
Is Vivint the only one that's doing this?
There are a lot of different companies that are making individual pieces of stuff. You know, these remote locks are not new. Mm-hmm. There are remote control light switches that you can control from your phone. None of these individual things are new. What really makes this a great experience, however, was the combination of everything in a single application that, you know, all of this software work together.
The importance of smartphones. I mean, it just goes to show. Although, could you use this on a tablet too?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Anything that runs Android or you know iOS, you know the Apple operating system. You could do it on an iPad. You can do it on any of the Android tablets. Really, a lot of this stuff you can do on any web browser. You know, they have a very interactive website that allows you to go through and adjust all of these things. It's just very compelling to have that kind of power in your hand.
So that said, how easy will it be for hackers and other criminals to gain access to the Vivint passwords in people's phones? I mean, everything can be busted into, right? It's just another
There
lock.
Is certainly something to be said for, you know, there's definitely, you know, where there's a will, there's a way when it comes to someone, you know, gaining access to any kind of thing that requires a password. However, the guys at Vivint seem to have done a lot of homework here to make sure that it's as safe as you allow it to be. Obviously, everything is backed by a password. So if they can guess your password or if they can guess the password that you've entered on your phone, then they can gain access to this kind of security. But if you've got a strong password, you send the same chance of keeping your house secure that you would, you know, keeping an email address or something like that secure. And today, that's really, you stand a pretty good chance.
This would be sort of eliminate the need for a key, right? You could just unlock your door with your smartphone?
That's correct, yeah. You wouldn't really need a key for the doors, and you'd be able to, you know, unlock as you get out of the car or, you know, lock as you're walking away from the car. And you know, certainly with these things, they still offer keys. You know, they still make it so that you can get through, you know, let's say the power on your phone dies out. You know, mm-hmm. You can certainly still do things the old-fashioned way, as it were,
mm-hmm.
But it's not a requirement that you do it.
Are they hard digitally. To use?
Not at all. I've found these incredibly simple to use.
I don't really count you as an average user, though, Russell, just for the record.
So the way that I judge any of this kind of stuff is I take things like this and I hand them to, you know, my wife, or I hand it to, you know, my mother or something like that. And I hand it to them and just kind of take a step back and see how they figure it out. And there's not been any, you know, any questions that they didn't answer in a couple of seconds themselves. The app itself is very easy to use. It's great big buttons that say, you know, locks and camera and temperature and things like that. It's been a pretty great way to see all of this stuff come together.
So what are we talking about in the cost department?
It definitely varies. They offer a couple of different monthly packages, the average of which is about $60 a month if you want everything in your house set up, you know, the locks and the electronic light switches and the thermostat and everything. But they also have less expensive packages if you just want like the basic security system and things like that. So it really bases on, you know, what your individual need is. In some markets, you know, they have a couple of different deals for installation. So I don't really know what the base price for the installation is, but they do basically replace, you know, your security panel and your thermostat and the locks on your doors, and they install, you know, anything that you don't already have in your house that is compatible with Vivint, they replace on installation.
Yeah, the issue of energy costs, some users are saying that they've saved as much as $90 a month because of the energy management component, but you have to interact with it. You have to use it. It doesn't just do it automatically, right?
Some of the stuff it'll do automatically. The thermostat, for example, is an intelligent thermostat that'll you know, work with the ambient temperature of the house and use the sensors that have been installed to gauge the temperature, you know, in places and generally be more efficient. But if you're talking about just basic power, you know, setups, then those are certainly things that you have to interact with. But again, it's, you know, they're very simple, you know, on off use or don't use features, so that if you decide to interact with the system, they can be much better.
You also wanted to talk about Google buying Motorola Mobility.
This is a pretty significant thing. This was proposed a while back, and, you know, like a lot of these kind of larger deals, it depended pretty heavily on the governments of the world deciding that it was okay and making sure that there were no other companies that had any objections. And then finally, late last week, it came together where Google bought the hardware company Motorola. We've seen Motorola do a lot of different things in the past, but specifically things like their set-top boxes, their TV boxes that are used by companies like Comcast and Verizon, and their cell phone and tablet company have been purchased by Google.
So the regulators in the U.S. and the European Union approved it, but they were waiting for China? What was the
That's
China
right.
deal?
It took China a while, and this is kind of an interesting thing that takes a little while longer to explain, so I'll be as brief as possible. China and Google have not really gotten along in recent years.
Right.
So, you know, Google wants all of their search results across the world, regardless, to be the same, and China disagrees with that. So there's a lot of back and forth with that, and there was a lot of concern that because of that back and forth, China would not approve this merger, but they did eventually.
So Google says they're going to keep Motorola running as an independent business. Why are they doing that? And do you believe that's really going to last, or is that what they're just saying right now?
Well, that's certainly what they're saying right now, and it's important that they continue to say that for the immediate future, because Google has a lot of partners. You know, Google is the company that makes the operating system called Android, but they don't actually make any cell phones. You know, so they don't make any cell phones, they don't make any tablets. You know, these companies, Sony and HTC and Samsung and all of these companies make the hardware, that they take the software from Google and install it on the hardware. But, you know, if these companies decide that, you know, Google is kind of trying to cut them out, then they could stop the Android ecosystem, you know, pretty much flat and move on to other things. And so it's important right now for Google to continue saying, you know, we're not jumping into the hardware business. We're, you know, the party line right now, as it stands, is that they bought Motorola for their patent portfolio so that they could better defend themselves against companies that were trying to sue their business partners for the violations that were going on with their smartphones.
So now Google, some analysts have said, may move into the cable box business, if there is such a thing anymore, with Google TV.
Well, you know, a lot of companies are still focusing on the cable box for the house, especially, you know, the DVRs that act as cable boxes as well.
Right.
Comcast, you know, they are constantly, you know, releasing new cable boxes to put in houses. And Motorola has been a big part of Comcast's work for a while. But Google also has a vested interest in their television, you know, their smart TV service with Google TV. So it really wouldn't be far-fetched to see Google try to release a Motorola cable box that had Google TV running on it to try and get a company like Comcast to start putting them in people's houses for them.
And is it worth it to talk about Larry Page, the Google CEO, who announced that, actually not him, but the guy that he announced would be the new CEO of Motorola Mobility, Dennis Woodside. What do we know about him? Does it matter to know anything?
There's nothing, you know, particularly. I don't want to say that there's nothing special about him, but there's nothing that really stands out as far as him being the choice to go and take over, especially with Sanjay Jha being the guy that he was replacing. But really, it was just you know, the right person for the job as far as those guys were concerned.
It makes you wonder if we're not leaving that era of this personality-driven tech sector. You know, after a while, it's not going to be so much new under the sun that it will be driven by an individual.
Well, I mean, I certainly think that there's definitely room for personality for the next little while. And I don't know that it's going to be, you know, without it anytime soon. But there's definitely a lot moving towards the direction of a more kind of ubiquitous feel to it.
I want to talk about that Leap, the Connect competitor for the PC.
Oh, right.
It's amazing. I watched the video of it this morning, and it's pretty amazing how it works. But it's already, the technology's already out there, right?
Well, it's already out there in a not quite as advanced fashion. The difference between what exists right now and the Leap system is pretty different, and that's kind of where it's significant. Microsoft released a service called Kinect for the Xbox 360 a while ago, and it was really neat in that it had these three cameras, three different kinds of cameras that all work together to capture your motion and you know, your movements in an attempt to, you know, really control your games and you know, be able to sit on the couch and talk to your television or be able to wave your hand and move things across the television. But you know, they really want to take this experience and move it to a computer. And the way that Kinect is set up, you really have to sit a pretty decent way back, and you obviously can't do that with a computer. So the guys from Leap were trying to create that same experience, but with, you know, less than 3 feet reach between you and your computer. So they had to be a lot more accurate with how it detected your movements and how it could tell, you know, which parts of your finger were actually moving and giving commands and take that. So it is the same basic concept, but it's a whole lot more refined so that it can be accurate enough to use on computers.
It's just a little device. It's a little bit bigger than a flash drive.
It's really not that big. And you know, when you take a look at, you know, the camera part on the back of your smartphone, for example, you know, those parts are really not that big anymore. You know, so they can take those things and they can work them together into a thing. And all the real processing and you know, the power that drives it still comes from your computer. It plugs in, you know, it connects wirelessly, or, you know, it plugs in with a USB cable. But all of the actual processing of that information still happens on your computer. So it's able to be small.
So you just plug this into your PC and you can how does it work? What do you have to do to install?
So right now it's still a little limited. It's still pretty technical. You know, you are able to control a certain amount of space on your screen with you know, hand gestures and things like that. And it's still, you know, very much in development. You can buy them now, but it's not going to benefit a whole lot of people to be able to reach your hand up and do things aside from playing games at the moment. But the long-term goal is to be able to control your entire screen with it.
I noticed on the video that I saw that if you want to write with it, it's only temporary, the writing. It's kind of like writing in the sky.
Right.
Like with the broomstick. It disappears.
Yeah, it does. It disappears. And, you know, so the goal there is that if there's a place that you are writing something in, then you can, you know, or maybe you've been emailed something that you have to respond with your signature or something like that, mm-hmm. that you can just draw your signature quickly and it'll paste that to whatever the document it is, and then it would email it back to somebody.
It's not expensive. But $70.
Yeah, these are really not expensive, and that's the great thing about this is that, you know, as cool as the Leap is as a separate concept, I really think that within the next year we're going to see similar pieces of technology, maybe not necessarily made by Leap, but similar pieces of technology actually built into our laptops and our tablets and our desktops. You know, we do a lot of things with our tablets and our smartphones right now where we reach out and we touch things, and fingerprints are kind of gross. If you've got a laptop, you can, you know, you can swipe back and forth with your hand, just kind of gesturing in the air and not have to worry about, you know, any kind of smudging or anything like that. And you're still getting the same effect that you would from reaching out and touching your tablet.
It's always funny how you talk about it could be a while before we see something. They're looking at early next year, which really isn't that far away.
Well, I mean, unfortunately,
I mean, it's always got to be Russell time. What does Russell mean by a long time?
when you live in a world where a new cell phone comes out every other day, a long time for me is, you know, 2 or 3 months.
I know. Hey, we have an unrelated email from John. He asks, how do you block unwanted text messages on T-Mobile? Any ideas?
So if you want to block unwanted text messages on T-Mobile, depending on which phone you have, T-Mobile actually has an administrative panel on their website that will allow you to go through and set up whitelists and things like that for certain calls, and that'll work for text messages as well. As an aside, if you have a smartphone, if you have you know, an iPhone that's been modified for T-Mobile or an Android phone, then you can actually use Google Voice or similar applications to just flat out block that number altogether. So there's a couple options available.
All right. Well, Russell Holly, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me back.
Russell Holly, tech blogger for geek.com. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from Montgomery & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, providing a disciplined approach to help individuals and small businesses grow and maintain their wealth. TheMontgomerySolution.com.